Listen, Anna. I've got to tell you the truth. I've done everything you've said. Everything. I've deceived you, and I've lied to you. Because I'm so crazy about you, I'd have done anything as long as I could be with you. Now, go on. Nothing you can say will be bad enough.
And now...
From the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo. At least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hey, everybody. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. This is your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness from Los Angeles. And coming at you from the Motor City Motown, Detroit, Michigan, it's the Motor City Madman, Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Look at me go. I'm having a lovely rainy Labor Day weekend here in the Michigan state.
What could be a more appropriate symbolic end to summer than a rainy day?
Oh, right. I'm looking out the window. Perhaps you hear it, the pitter patter on the windows over my head. I don't know.
I like to think that pitter patter are just the footsteps of sweet Loki.
Yes, Loki's been out on the upper deck hunting all morning. Hunting for what, I'm not sure. But I think he did escape during the week, went under the deck, and came out with a face full of spider webs. Oh, it was adorable. Of course, well, terrorized us. But
Loki's no different than the rest of us. Loki is hunting for what we're all hunting for, Dean, meaning. Meaning is what...
is everything meaningless above deck, but below deck is where you find true.
Oh my goodness. Wow, what a metaphor we've just lucked into. I don't know if it's good luck or bad luck, but we found it and it found us and it's not gonna let us go. But yes, Labor Day, always a very sad weekend. For me growing up, but nowadays, what? Well, you know, the symbolic end of summer, right?
That thing.
Memorial Day being the start of summer, Labor Day being the end of summer, the rules about white shoes, you know, it was always just such a sad, sad thing. But I'm not even sure that it operates as a symbolic end of summer anymore. I mean, kids are going back to school beginning of August now.
I know. Right? That's so weird. There was just last week, the school near our place, packed already with a how do you do to school. So, I don't know.
With a how do you do? Well, that's nice. Not a welcome back to school or a meet and greet, just a how do you do? We're going to have a big how do you do. I love that. That's going to be... oh, man, it's a Chill Pack Hollywood. How do you do? All right. Hey, at the outset of today's show, and what a wide variety of topics do we have for you on the docket today. But at the outset, you heard a clip from the 1932 movie Downstairs, starring John Gilbert, from a screen story by John Gilbert. Why did you hear this, you might wonder? And if you listened and retained our discussion from last week, then you're probably already aware of why we would, even if at first you didn't know it was John Gilbert, you do now know why we brought it up. But it's all explained in an email we got from a listener. You're stunned.
I'm stunned. Yeah, no. I was waiting to hear the email. I thought you were going to go transition smoothly into the email.
Oh, you want me to share the email? Well, I don't mind if I do. I don't mind if I do. Because
seemed like a perfect setup.
Yes. All right. Well, this is why we have these little rehearsals. Yeah. if you'll recall, I out and out threw an audio gauntlet to our loyal listener, Maurice Terenzio, last week. And he was certainly person enough to pick that gauntlet up. I jump into the, after the initial greeting, the email. Let's start with where he says, where shall we begin? Why not start with Dean's comment regarding John Gilbert's voice? Now, Dean must be completely forgiven for perpetuating this myth.
A myth indeed.
Nearly everyone has done so at one time or another. And if you tell a myth often enough, the myth becomes truth.
Right.
The problem with this truth is that it doesn't bear scrutiny. Gilbert made a number of talkies, 11 to be precise, and his voice is fine. Case in point, the scene that we excerpted at the outset from downstairs. Indeed, he has quite a rich baritone, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, rich. He doesn't have the mid-Atlantic accent that we were so used to back in the day, with that slight English clip to it. But, some of his M's and his N's are mumbled off the end.
You are nitpicking. I found it quite delightful. I found it actually quite modern.
Yes, very modern. I'll give you that.
And so much better than the mid-Atlantic accent of which we were used.
Right.
So his voice is fine. And by all rights, Gilbert should have had the same sort of successful career enjoyed by William Powell. But life is rarely fair. Gilbert's downfall has more to do with offending the powerful Louis B. Mayer than to any vocal deficiencies.
Well, and it's even thought that Louis B. Mayer rigged the first microphone by putting it behind a fountain so that it would come across as reedy, tinny, and thin. That was the thought.
So, I long for the days when I was reedy, tinny, and thin. Between the symbolic beginning and end of summer, this kid lost his reedy, tinny, and thin shape. But anyway, Louis B. Mayer, Breakfast Clubber, Louis B. Mayer, by the way.
Of course. Yeah, right.
Which brings us to the second part of Maurice's email. And reminds that I mentioned we were going to be enjoying a wonderful presentation at the Breakfast Club. And ooh, wasn't it wonderful? From Sue Lloyd, granddaughter of Harold Lloyd, who actually referred to her grandfather as dad because she was raised by him and raised there at Green Acres.
Of course.
It was a wonderful, wonderful presentation on Harold Lloyd's 3D photographic collection. He documented all his trips around the world, everything that he did with 3D stereoscopic photography. Anyway,
stereoscopic. Yes.
Maurice continues, with that out of the way, let's deal with Harold Lloyd. And with Lloyd, there are a number of points to touch upon. Dean's comment about Lloyd's hand injury was quite correct. He did lose the thumb and forefinger of his right hand. However, Dean also mentioned that it was caused by a firecracker at an early age. This implies that it was a childhood accident, which it was not.
No,
unless, I didn't. Unless, of course, one uses a very liberal definition of the word childhood.
I often do, though. You know, I'm still in my second childhood right here, and that's a liberal applied.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So Lloyd's accident occurred while he was taking publicity photos at the age of 26.
Right.
He was photographed holding a lit prop bomb that unfortunately was not a prop.
So herein lies the problem with the props department. Why would you have a real, I mean, the cartoon bomb you didn't think was actually mirrored after the real bomb?
Well, let's not assume that there was a props department involved in the publicity photos. We don't know. We can't know that.
We cannot.
So anybody involved with the shoot, apparently. But what I love, theoretically, then, Dean, is you go through the photos from that shoot, you will have five-fingered Harold Lloyd, and then later in the shoot, you will have three-fingered Harold Lloyd.
I'm guessing after the explosion, they didn't continue photographing. I'm going to suggest that as a thing in 1926.
That sound I hear is Maurice's correction for next week.
Okay, I may be totally wrong.
There's a phrase about the show going on, Dean, that I don't know. And we should take that to heart. So here we go. We continue. To Lloyd's talkies, and that's a tough two words to say together, Lloyd's talkies. He did make a half dozen talkies between 1929 and his retirement in 1938. He came out of retirement for one more picture in 1947, making a total of 7 talking movies. But was his transition to talkies successful? Well, yes and no, depending on how you measure success.
Exactly.
Lloyd's voice certainly did suit him, and his first talkie, Welcome Danger, oh my goodness, was a major box office smash. Welcome Danger is also the name of this week's Chill Pack Hollywood, How Do You Do?
How Do You Do? That reminds me of the time I auditioned for Movie of the Week, Mother May I Sleep with Danger. I think it was the sequel.
Oh, God, that's so good. All right. So it was a major box office smash in 1929. The problem is that it is a bad film now, and it was a bad film then. Not surprisingly, fans came out in droves to hear how Lloyd sounded, but weren't overly keen on what they saw.
Mm.
His next film, Feet First, 1930, saw profit, but not a great profit. His third film, Movie Crazy, 1932, made even less profit. His fourth talkie, The Cat's Paw, which is a title that I love, by the way.
Right.
1934 was in the red at the box office. However, it is not only my personal favorite Lloyd talkie, it may also be the finest example of a 30s comedy. So I cannot wait to check this one out.
The Cat's Paw.
Lloyd, seeing the negative reaction his previous films were receiving, decided to go with a more modern approach and show that his dexterity was not just with visual humor, but verbal as well. In this, he was successful. But unfortunately, not enough people cared enough to come out and see it. So I will forward the link where we can both watch Cat's Paw if you're interested in it.
I am. I'm very interested. I was
a lot of people
thinking.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people like Lloyd's fifth talkie, The Milky Way, 1936, including our very own Dean Haglund.
That's the one.
But once again, Lloyd's box office was covered with red. He made one more box office flop, Professor Beware. Now, please tell me that you auditioned for a Movie of the Week sequel to that.
Mother, May I Sleep with Professor Beware.
What? It's an inappropriate student-teacher relationship. So Lloyd retires as an actor. The truth is, none of this really mattered. He managed to not only save his money, but invested wisely. Indeed, as we learned in this program with Sue, I mean, he was Hollywood royalty all his life. I mean, he was close friends with the major producers and stars all the way up through the 1960s.
Right.
So he was a person of genuine import in this town long after he retired. But I have no idea where Dean dug up that tidbit of misinformation, and that misinformation was about Little Rascals or Our Gang, because he never produced any of those. He did, however, produce a couple of features at RKO, the pleasant but inconsequential romantic comedy A Girl, A Guy, and A Gob, starring George Murphy, Lucille Ball, and Edmund O'Brien. He also produced My Favorite Spy, starring Kay Kaiser, Ellen Drew, yes, and Jay Wyman. And how much do we love Kay Kaiser?
Yeah.
And who has an appearance in a character that's very similar to Lloyd himself. Essentially, it is a Harold Lloyd comedy with Kay Kaiser filling in for him. So that sounds fascinating.
Right.
In 1947, however, Lloyd was persuaded by no less a personage than Preston Sturgis to come out of retirement and star in Sturgis's The Sin of Harold Diddlebach.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. And that's a film I enjoy. And yet I did not remember. I didn't realize or put it together that that was Harold Lloyd.
Right.
The Cats, along with the Cat's Paw, Diddlebach is our friend Maurice's favorite Lloyd talkie. Unfortunately, it received scant distribution by United Artists when it was made. A re-edited version was released by RKO in 1950 under the title Mad Wednesday. It also did not fare well at the box office. Now, it's interesting. Not surprisingly, Lloyd and Sturgis did not work well together. The problem was obvious. They were each comic geniuses who had their own vision as to how a film should be. And
gags set up and all that sort of thing.
So Lloyd, whenever he would bring up the film over the next couple decades, would talk about it not being very good. But in 1970, shortly before Lloyd passed away, Rich Corell persuaded Lloyd to watch the film he had not seen in over 20 years. When it was over, Lloyd remarked, "Why, it was much better than I had remembered. It's actually very good." So I brought this up with Sue Lloyd, actually. And this, of course, is the memory of someone who was then quite young, right?
Right.
She said that when she was a little girl, it was a movie of which he was quite proud, and that he always, when talking about it, would wax rhapsodic about what a great writer Preston Sturgis was. So,
okay.
So who knows? There you go. So who knows? So I'm wondering, and we'll never know. We can never get to the bottom of this. But publicly, outwardly, one wonders if the criticisms he would level against it and not liking it was a way of distancing himself from the sting of the fact that the public had not warmly embraced the movie.
But that's always the thing, right? All films are in context, regardless of how or who made them. That is the forever elusive goal of making movies.
And so thank you for Maurice Terenzio for writing literally one third of this episode of your Chill Back Hollywood Hour. Dean Haglund, I need to switch gears really quickly to talk to you about Gravity Hole.
Okay. Did we switch gears? That was the sound of the gear switching.
That silence. We'll just drop in the gear switching sound effect. Did you drop a new live streaming episode of it this week?
We did. There was a little technical hitch here and there. So we're going to do it again tonight. If you are listening, when are you posting this? Sunday?
No, Monday. So, Monday at 9 a.m. How long have we been doing this? Monday at 9 a.m. the show drops. Yes.
Right. So if you were up before you heard this show, we did stream Gravity Hole. And you could see all the episodes, of course, at gravityhole.com. But we are going to endeavor to do live on numerous platforms, including YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Twitch, and Mixer to start and grow from there.
To start. Okay, so we're still saying we're going to start Gravity Hole. How many episodes do we have?
We have 25 episodes.
Already?
Already in the can, yeah. Because each show is exactly 20 minutes long because we set off a self-destruct detonator.
That I get. That our loyal listeners have gotten already.
Right.
We've explained that. What I think we need an explanation on is when do these shows come out and why? And if a show is released into the vacuum of space, does anybody hear that it's been released?
Right.
Yes. So not a lot of chatter across the various platforms about y'all doing these shows live.
Right.
So
not yet. We want to get our technical hitches out, and then we'd get a smooth, and then we're also building a chance for guests to arrive on the ship in a quarantine room and also blow up.
Okay.
With us. So
it's been a soft launch, we can
soft
say.
Launch.
I didn't know that the space program, like a department store, would have a soft launch, but
yeah, that's how we do space.
Okay.
You know,
because
we get our healthy right.
I found out about it the same way other people found out about it, not on your Facebook or your Instagram or anything like that, but just a Twitter, just a tweet that you released about how the show was about to go live, and like all your Twitter followers, I enjoyed 52 seconds of Gravity Hole. And that's not a condescending review where I say I enjoyed 52 seconds of the 22-minute show. The rest, but it was literally I think were treated to 52 seconds, and then the feed failed.
Well, yes and or no. It seems that Twitter doesn't have a limiter in live streaming. So we're just working through that technical thing that's unique to Twitter. It seems like they have 260 characters and only 140 seconds of streaming time available to the average user. So that also requires some checking on my part. So
okay, all right. So the soft launch was intentional. And we're trying to work out all the bugs, but there's 25 shows already for people to catch up on.
That's right. Go to gravityhole.com for all your comedy needs.
I mean,
a sci-fi comedy that's as mindless as you can imagine.
So 22 minutes long, each and every episode, exactly 22 minutes?
Exactly. Though there's a couple camera failures where we blow the ship up early. So that's our safety. If there's any sort of technical glitch, we just have a button and we could just blow up the whole thing.
All right.
So we ended almost like every Muppets sketch. If you remember the Muppets, when they didn't know how to end it, they just had the Mad Bomber come in and blow it up. So we're kind of doing that.
Okay. So at least 500 minutes of watching Dean Haglund get blown up over and over and over again.
Right.
And really, it is time, as the kids would say, for someone as mad talented as Dean Haglund to finally blow up.
Hey, see what you said?
Okay.
That's funny. We're using that one.
Last week, I spoke of a couple of young female performers of Asian American descent who are either blowing up or damn well ought to blow up because they are so gifted. One was Awkwafina, currently starring in the theatrical release by A24, The Farewell, which means maybe it'll get some award love later in the season. I would certainly hope so. Certainly maybe Indie Spirit, maybe Screenplay Awards. Nominations. And the other was the terrific Maya Erskine. I don't know, Maya from Plus One. And no sooner than had I sung her praises on this show than Lily was quick to point out that Maya played one of Lily's students in the Geffen Theater stage production, Coney Island Christmas.
What? That's amazing.
Yes. So,
And it's also amazing that you two didn't discuss it, but you conversed on Facebook about it. I thought you were both living in the same location would have the ability just to talk about it.
Yeah, but we, you know, we're not. I don't know. We're not chained at the hip all the time, right? We have our own pursuits. She's out, you know, performing the live immersive theater that the kids go crazy for. And I'm here changing the way people listen to the internet. So it's, you know, and never the twain shall meet.
Never the twain shall meet, apparently. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
It just, you know, I thought there was...
You know, by the time we're finally together again, late at night, I mean, there's very little energy left to say anything other than here, eat your food. So, you know how it is. All right.
Sure.
Anyway, so that was very exciting. And I love that you knew that exchange. I didn't know about a gravity hole episode dropping, but you knew about that. Anyway, but I thought because of that, I would bring up maybe one more actor whose work I have really, really realized I enjoy, and that this guy should be in a lot more. I don't know if he will blow up, but ooh, what a versatile actor he is. And I know his work now, I think, exclusively through the films of Sean Baker. I told you how I went back in reverse chronological order and watched all of Sean Baker's movies.
Yeah.
And, oh, man, this actor, Karan Karagoulian, who is in, I think, all of his movies, starting with Takeout. This guy is so good, Dean. He plays lead roles in Prince of Broadway. He plays a Broadway merchant dabbling in, you know, black market goods. Backroom black market goods, who has only recently received a green card through a rather awkward marital situation. In Tangerine, he plays the cab driver that we follow, who has a rather contentious marriage and a rather startling romance or affection for one of the trans prostitutes who are the subjects of the film. And in Starlet, before that, he plays the head of the porn film company. And these are three characters with such wildly different, not only personalities, but energies.
Right.
And Karagoulian embodies these energies so truthfully, and he's a riveting actor to watch who is always so believable.
Wow.
I'd been meaning to talk about him, but I thought, what better time than after I sang the praises of these other actors? So Karan Karagoulian, I want to track this guy down. I want him in my movies.
Well, he was in the Florida Project, and you loved that one so much, didn't you?
Yes. That was Sean Baker. He's in all of Baker's movies. Yeah.
Wow. So. Look at that.
But I had become aware of him before Florida Project, and so that's why I kind of focused on some of these. It was really Tangerine where you go, oh, my God, who is this guy? This guy's really good. And then you go back through the movies, and you go, oh, my God, he's so different in Starlet and so funny and so real. He's fantastic. Fantastic.
Fantastic. I want to see this now, this feller. This guy.
Now, speaking of Lily Holloman, of whom we were speaking,
right?
You know, in addition to her being a part of the Pack Theater's house improv team, Nuisance, which performs every Tuesday, Dean, she's going to be plying her comedic improv wares this Thursday as the guest driver in the big improv stage show, Big Yellow Taxi. It's a show where they combine, basically it's Taxi Cab Confessions meets improv comedy.
I think I like this show that I've never seen.
I've never seen it either, but that's kind of a great premise right there. And each week, it's a different cab driver. It's a guest star as the cab driver who's there on stage throughout. And that will be Lily Holloman this Thursday.
Wow.
So that might very well be next week's live event of the week.
Well, I think you'd have to go. What stage is that go on at?
That's the PAC Theater there in Hollywood, California. They're, you know, Theater Row there on Santa Monica Boulevard by the by the complex. Yeah.
The complex. Fantastic. Well, that I want to hear all about because I unfortunately will not be there to see it. I am, of course, teaching improv here in Michigan at the Go Comedy Theater. So that has eaten up my days, as it were.
Well, this week's lesson, don't live stream your comedy on Twitter, I guess, will be the...
There you go. That's a sad thing to say about Twitter. I don't know. So, well, I will figure it out.
Dean, this week we had the Screen Actors Guild, the SAG-AFTRA elections for officers and board members, both local and national. Did you participate in the election this year? Did you vote?
I did. I sent my votes in. Wait, did I? Oh, shit. No, that's my ballot right there. I filled it out. I didn't mail it. Oh, I feel terrible. My office is a mess.
It was, I think, maybe something along the lines of 20% voted for the officers and 13% voted for the, you know, for the board members. It was a contentious and conflicted election. And as is national politics, and this is really the descent we've been charting for the more than a decade we've been doing this show, but how much union politics, right? And we say this as Americans. We have so much more in common than we have different, and yet it's utter blood sport. And how much more true an adage could it possibly be that within a union you have more in common than you could possibly have dividing you? And yet, sure enough, it has become a two-party blood sport. And with different efforts at independent candidates and third party candidates, but really two major parties have emerged. And so just like general politics, right? A shocking dearth of eligible voters actually participate. And I'm looking at you, Dean Haglund.
Yes, you are.
But it's so it's contentious, it's conflicted, meaning that at last reading, there might even be questions as to whether it was a legitimate election.
What?
And so, but the results as we know them were that Gabriel Carteris beat Matthew Modine, my two sons, Matthew and Modine. but Matthew Modine's side picked up seats in the, you know, the local board election.
Right.
But, you know, there was recently a poll that showed that 4 out of 10 Americans won't trust the results of the next presidential election, regardless of who wins. And I feel like that is, you know, where we're at with the guild elections, the distrust of the election process itself.
And damn it, eh?
Wow. And I don't know how you get greater involvement, greater turnout, if you're starting from a basis of people not trusting it to begin with.
Yeah, right. So this is the whole thing. Going back to our documentary, The Truth Is Out There, of when you start doubting the truth itself, then everything kind of unravels. Then there's fake news. All, you know, and this idea that truth is out there as opposed to a priori fact then you sort of have an entire unraveling of reality where you are standing in the midst of, I don't believe anything, including election results.
That's a really good point. So the idea of the truth being out there as opposed to facts, you can find facts, but it's up to you to make truth.
Right.
The truth always resides within you. And the truth is always, we could argue, subjective. That there are facts that are not subjective, but the truth is. So therefore, it is dependent upon the point of view and the perception of the observer to create right. that truth. Or as we always say, as storytellers, right? It takes two to create meaning. Don't always right. ask the author or the filmmaker or the painter what something means for a variety of reasons. But one of the most important reasons is their point of view on what it means might be more informed in terms of the amount of information they have at their disposal in terms of what's contained within that work. But their interpretation of it is only a singular interpretation and holds no more value or weight than yours as an observer.
Right. So therefore, if there is meaning and equal weighted value to two completely different interpretations, then no interpretation is... You could argue then that no interpretation is ever correct.
Well, it is correct for you. Right. And there are facts. There are such a thing as facts. And that's what we have to get back to.
I know.
But
if I could go, well, those facts are an interpretation of reality, then I can always undermine facts.
Which is why, yeah, we're a horribly anti-intellectual and rather thick-headed and dense populace. But I would say that interestingly enough, that explains why there's less and less turnout, less and less involvement in every election, and oh, by the way, really, the same people tend to collect and obtain more and more power all the time as a result. Right. Boy, it favors somebody, right? It always favors someone when we are turned against each other. And this has always been the name of the game. Before it being our lack of trust in political outcomes. And hello, talk to people of color about their faith in the electoral system through the years, right?
Right.
And yet they will participate. But this has always been the name of the game economically as well, right? Turn people at the bottom against each other. The people at the top can amass more power more easily.
Right.
So the name of the game with these elections is, if you don't trust it, counterintuitively, it's not don't participate, it's participate in greater numbers, because whatever problems there are, if there's any monkey business going on to legitimize your lack of trust, it's going to be harder for that monkey business to hold sway and carry the day, the greater the turnout in an election.
Right.
And always demand transparency, right? Demand a paper trail. That's
yes.
the big thing. Have paper ballot backups for all voting. But to bring this to Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA, it's kind of shocking that I think that fewer, that such a low percentage participates in this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it is shocking. I mean, and here I am, the guy who forgot to mail in his ballot. And it's too late now, isn't it?
Well, so. There will be others. They will hold others, Dean. They will hold other elections. All right. Hey, we need to open up the Chill Pack Morgue. And this is a good time to do it. Because the first person that we need to remember was someone who was very active in Screen Actors Guild politics for many years. So let's do a little something we call celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Valerie Harper, Dean, ran for office many times for SAG.
Many times.
She was the Emmy-winning actress who starred in The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Rhoda, playing the colorful and spunky Rhoda Morgenstern. Also appeared in such movies as Freebie and the Bean and Chapter 2, for which she received Golden Globe nominations.
Right.
And she was Tony nominated for her work. I cannot even describe the kind of cancer she died from at the age of 80. It is, but I'm going to try, I am going to try, leptomeningeal carcinomatosis? Did I come?
Leptomeningeal, carcinomatosis is not even gonna. If it's leptomeningeal, then that says it's lung.
Oh, very good. Well, let's dig into this a little bit. She was born in 1939 in New York, daughter of a nurse and a salesman. Grew up all over the country as her family moved around to accommodate her father's job. So, I mean, that's the classic story of how a show person was born, right? Trotting the boards all across the country. She trained as a ballerina and got her start as a performer on Broadway working as a dancer. Now, am I correct in remembering that that was how Mary Tyler Moore herself got started?
I think you're right. They were both...
So they're
dancers.
Yeah, so kindred backgrounds in that regard, and so believably playing best friends in the Mary Tyler Moore Show, right?
Isn't that something?
She dreamt of acting, and her talent for comedy got her noticed by Chicago's Second City, where she worked for several years in the 1960s.
The golden years of Second City.
How about talking to me a little bit about this, Dean? You are someone who studied the modern dance. I mentioned John C. Reilly's work at the Hollywood Bowl narrating Peter and the Wolf last week. But there is quite a natural connection between musical performers and dancers and comedy.
Yes.
Is it as simple as just understanding timing?
Is it as simple? No. I mean, there's also a physical expression of humor and learning how to communicate. You know, as I tell my students, you only have two tools when you are on stage communicating. You have your voice and you have your body. And those two tools should at all times be expressive and limber and worked up. Is that the term? So dance is a great way to heighten your comedy chops.
Yes, we have our body and when we have our voice, we certainly don't have our vocabulary where we incorrectly use words like exacerbate.
Yes.
I also bring another skill up on stage. I bring a flamethrower.
You do?
Yeah, that's another tool that I use. Yeah.
Technically, that's a prop, though. That is not a tool.
This is how Harold Lloyd got into trouble.
Exactly. It's not a tool of the stagecraft. It is a prop.
That was another Chillpack Hollywood Hour. How do you do? Or what's the name of it? I don't remember. All right.
How you going?
So,
oh, no, that's not.
Harper got her big break, of course, with the supporting role on Mary Tyler Moore Show, and she won 3 Emmy Awards in consecutive years, 71, 72, and 73. I think between that and Rhoda, she was nominated for maybe 8 straight Emmy Awards.
Wow.
And Rhoda, the spinoff, was a hit, becoming the first and to date only show ever to achieve a #1 Nielsen rating with its pilot episode.
What? I didn't know that.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing. That's a lot of pressure on your pilot right there.
She became a fixture in television movies and then in the 80s starred on a third sitcom, Valerie. And this show didn't achieve the success, obviously, of her previous shows. How could they, really? But she was removed after the second season, but the show continued for additional seasons under other names, including the Hogans. She sued Lorimar Television for wrongful firing, and the jury agreed, and she won a nice, healthy compensation package from the jury. It was kind of a big deal at the time. Yeah.
Isn't that something?
So let's see. Some of the later credits. She saw new success on stage. She played Golda Meir in the one-woman show Golda's Balcony. She received a Tony nomination for her portrayal of Tallulah Bankhead in Looped. And she made appearances on such television shows as Touched by an Angel, Melrose Place, Drop Dead Diva, and, of course, she voiced several characters on The Simpsons.
Of course. How could she not?
She was diagnosed with lung cancer. Dean Haglund, you're a winner. In 2013, she announced that the cancer cells... cancer cells had spread to her brain, and that was why she was fighting leptomeningeal carcinomatosis.
All right. That's where the clusters from the lung, everything migrates.
Here's the thing, though. In 2013, she was given months to live. She responded well to the chemotherapy, though, and lived substantially longer than originally predicted. Valerie Harper, dead at the age of 80.
Wow.
Now,
amazing.
I've been giving a lot of thought to how much our contemporary economy of 2020, let's say, has similarities to the economy of 100 years ago. The great age of the robber barons following the Industrial Revolution.
All right. So we're talking copper and train moguls. Well, and George Westinghouse, these fellas, robber barons?
Well, you know, the middle class that was a phenomenon fairly unique to America and a product of the post-war America, let's not forget, and the product of social programs. I mean, those chickens coming home to roost are going to taste sweet and delicious, right? The America that distrusts socialism, and yet your beloved middle class is a product of social programs.
The New Deal.
Which explains why Canada, the dream of a middle class, is alive and well. Thank you very much. But the point is, we're back to having no middle class. We're back to you got the working poor, and you've got the very, very rich. And and any time anything needs to get done, it's because one of the very, very rich drops $3 billion in the name of some kind of charitable cause. And I bring all this up because I was thinking of it a lot in the wake of the death of David Koch, one of the co-owners of the Koch brothers, the Koch Industries, the second largest privately held company in the United States. Their holdings include subsidiaries in petroleum, chemicals, paper, financial products and services. I mean, I feel like you work in petroleum, chemicals, or financial products and services, you've got an express elevator to hell, and he's in all three. His personal assets were valued at over $42 billion earlier this year. Along with his older brother, Charles, David was heavily involved in financing political candidates and policies to further their libertarian and conservative views. Because, of course, they're ideologues and not at all interested in simply rolling back social protections that would prevent them from amassing obscene wealth. No, they're true idealists. The groups they funded included Americans for Prosperity, which backed the rise of the Tea Party. And we covered this a little bit back in the day, how they pretty much co-opted it, right? For the Republican Party. And it ends up biting the Republican Party on the ass in elections, right?
Yes.
So, They also backed the American Legislative Exchange Council, which writes model legislation for state legislators and lobbyists, and they have been so successful in this regard, where state houses have just adopted legislation that this exchange council had created.
Yes, carte blanche, because you are forced to fundraise so much money in politics, all of that sort of thing. There's no cap on how much money your super PAC can get. So as a elected official, you are basically doing events to raise money, nary have a moment to look even at the written bill that you are supposedly voting on. So you depend on these secondary companies to write this shit and then vote it without even having to look at it.
So their goals obviously have become central to the current Republican party, you know, which is in no, I think in no small way a little ironic, given that, you know, in 1980 he was the vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party.
I did not know that.
Right. And so we've never seen a rise of the Libertarian Party, but we've seen a rise of libertarianism in another party, in right. the Republican Party. And, you know, it begs the question, has it been effective? Well, it was effective for them. But right. has it really led to libertarianism? You know, can you change things from the inside, really, and stay true to your philosophy? It's a tough one. Yeah. Yeah. So, their main issues were obviously always tax cuts, weakening of environmental regulations, opposition to immigration, opposition to gun control, opposition to labor unions. He was the public face of the Koch brothers, not his older brother Charles, who very much shies away from the spotlight. In addition to running for vice president, he was also active on the New York social scene. And in addition to political causes, he was a philanthropist who donated generously to the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, the American Museum of Natural History, New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Right. Classics.
He, you know, battled prostate cancer for years. Now, I leave it all to you to decide whether that's delicious, delicious justice for the way that he fucked the American people up the ass for so long. But that's up to you.
I knew that was coming. I knew that joke was coming.
He gave millions of dollars to fund cancer research at institutes, including the Prostate Cancer Foundation, John Hopkins School of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering, gave $100 million to MIT in 2007 to construct the new Koch Institute for Integrative Cancer Research. In 2000, the U.S. Justice Department announced that Koch Industries would pay the largest civil fine ever imposed on a company to settle claims related to more than 300 oil spills from its pipelines and oil facilities in six states.
Right.
And yet, he wins, because here we are 20 years later, and the very laws and regulations that led to paying such an enormous fine aren't in place. They've all been rolled back.
So, so a slap on the wrist and his philanthropy due to minimize his tax liability, I would assume. You give to charity, and that limits that $45 billion personal hunk going to any government coffers at the IRS.
Now, that is quite the legacy for him to get added at the last moment. Television's very own Dean Haglund referring to him as a personal hunk. All right. Dean, I want you to tell me what you know or remember about the comedian Kip Adada, who died at the age of 75.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry to hear. I remember Kip Adada, watching him on all the talk shows. He was one of my favorites. I think Did I see him? I never got to see him live. I was in Vegas when he was performing at one of the casinos. He was a month-long show at the Golden Nugget, Mayon something. And yeah, Kippadonna, always coming up with bits, always kind of, for me, had a lot of physical comedy that I quite liked. So
I always
an inspiration.
I always remember that he would do, you know, and like you, I remember him from shows like, you know, Mike Douglas and American Bandstand. Even he would be on Dick Clark's shows, and in addition to the Tonight Show, in addition to the things that you think. But I remember that a lot of times he would do like a comedy that would teach you comedy, like his act was teaching you how to tell jokes. And I was reminded of that when I read this quote from a comedian who said during the comedy bust of the 90s, right after the big boom of all those comedy clubs being being built and watering it down, and then the comedy bust, Kippadonna went out of his way to help get us work. Very few comics have ever offered us this type of assistance when we needed it most. He did. We weren't friends with Kip, but he has a special place in our hearts. I think they went out of their way to say that we weren't friends with him because he was doing this. He was helping. If you were a comic, he was trying to help you, regardless of whether he knew you, right? It wasn't just trying to help his friends, which is enough, which is good enough. We know in this town how few of people really will help their friends. And that holds people in good stead. And he was just trying to help comics. And so I was reminded of, oh yeah, he had these routines that were also about, like, you know, committing to the joke and talking through, going all the way through the joke. Like, that was his stage thing. He had a nickname also, and I've been struggling to remember them, but I kind of go, oh yeah, I think I remember this. But known as the Master of the Pun.
I don't remember that, but okay. Was he a master of the pun?
Well, maybe some of our loyal Legion listeners, at least Mark Hershon, might be able to shed some light onto that and share something. Right. With us. All right. We need to get into a little bit of a lightning round here as we're down to our final few minutes of the show. Been meaning to remember this pioneering animation director for a few weeks now, Richard Williams, who was the animation director of the 1988 movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit. That was a pioneering film, we can say.
The first
effortlessly blend live actors with animated characters. It had been done, obviously, going back all the way to Mary Poppins and Song of the South, but really the interaction as if they were equal characters in equal realms was truly groundbreaking. He won an Oscar for Best Visual Effects on the film, as well as a Special Achievement Academy Award. He created many title sequences for movies, including two of Peter Sellers' Pink Panther films. So Richard Williams, dead at the age of 86.
Right.
Barbara March, someone I imagine that you may have crossed paths with at conventions from time to time. She was an actress best known for playing Lursa, one of the Klingon Duras sisters in Star Trek: The Next Generation, Star Trek: Deep Space Nine, and the feature film Star Trek Generations. The sisters were villains who were popular, very popular with the fans. Barbara March was a regular in the convention world. Her other credits include L.A. Law, and she had a longtime stage career, including, as you would expect, many Shakespearean roles. Because really, in Star Trek: The Next Generation, that's what these battles of rival houses became so Shakespearean in their grandeur, didn't they?
Absolutely. And she was a Canadian, if I remember correctly. So I'm sure she was at a theater festival, home of a spectacular Shakespeare.
She wrote the play, The Raising of Charlotte Bronte, and the novel, The Copper People. So a woman of letters as well. Dead of cancer at the age of 65.
Oh.
Now, well, they- Now, I don't know whether it's because of all this cancer talk that I want to pronounce this last name colon. It could be colon. I don't know. Maybe you know this legendary comic book artist who worked on Richie Rich, Casper the Friendly Ghost, and co-created a rock Son of Thunder. I really liked those comics, by the way, when I was a kid. Ernie Colon?
Colon. I've heard it pronounced Colon.
Well, that was by me just now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but he's born Puerto Rico, so it'd be Colon.
Oh, Colon. Yeah. Okay. All right. I love it. It's verified that he started at Harvey Comics as an uncredited artist on Richie Rich and Casper. He created a couple very popular fantasy titles at DC in the 1980s, and then he moved to Marvel Comics, working on the superhero comedy book Damage Control.
Fantastic. Damage Control. Mother, may I sleep with Damage Control?
I think Damage Control ought to be the name of the segment each week where Maurice Terenzio writes us about what we got wrong.
It's time for Damage Control.
Ernie died at the age of 88. And finally, Dean, not enough time to do justice to this person, but I dropped this little pebble into the water last week to see what ripples would emerge. I was struck by the fact that on the 50th anniversary of the start of Woodstock, that Peter Fonda would die.
Yeah.
Because there really, other than Woodstock, might be no greater icon of the late 1960s counterculture than Peter Fonda as Captain America, right?
Yeah. Right. Driving those Harleys, were they Harleys motorcycles?
That yeah, was I think so. Charge.
Yeah, yeah. That poster of the two of them on the road was in my sister's bedroom forever. I remember just seeing that growing up as a kid. That iconic image of the freedom of the road in leather fringes. Good Lord.
You know, the son of Hollywood loyalty, Hollywood royalty, Henry Fonda, right? Yeah. Peter Fonda becomes a huge star with Easy Rider, starring alongside Dennis Hopper, Jack Nicholson, a low-budget 1969 film at a time when, as you know, biker films were very, very popular. It didn't start the biker craze. It just took ample advantage of it. And it was about a pair of bikers living a hippie lifestyle of free love and drug use while clashing with authority and society. Such a huge hit. But more than that, a cultural touchstone for a generation, but also a film that blew the doors off of what it meant to be an independent filmmaker as well. And think about this. Fonda was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Screenplay for that film, along with his co-authors, again, Dennis Hopper, and Terry Southern, no less than Terry Southern, writer of, among other things, Dr. Strangelove. So, everybody knows this, right? But in addition to being the son of Hollywood royalty, he's the younger brother of Hollywood royalty, Jane Fonda. Right?
Jane Fonda. That's
even after the success of Easy Rider, when he could have landed traditional roles in studio films, he continued to be attracted to offbeat movies. Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry was I remember from being a kid, right?
That's right.
And when he has a comeback in the 1990s, receiving great acclaim and an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor, it's for playing an aging beekeeper and patriarch in the very sweet and quiet movie, Uli's Gold, which was an independent film. And what's interesting about it is he had completely embodied how Hollywood had changed, because this Uli's Gold film, if it had been made 25 years earlier, which it could have been, it would have been a studio film.
Yeah, right.
And quite frankly, it might have been a studio film starring his dad. That was the level of performance that Peter Fonda gave, right?
So,
and now here it was, the most independent of independent films. Fonda survived by two children, including actress Bridget Fonda. He died in Los Angeles of respiratory failure due to lung cancer. Here we are, right back with lung cancer, at the age of 79.
Wow.
So, yeah, I don't know why I was... It was a fascinating series of weeks, Dean, to have the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, followed by the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, and then to be reminded of Easy Rider and Peter Fonda, not just in terms of the cultural touchstone that he was politically and societally, but also in terms of how much that movie changed filmmaking and independent film. And fascinating to constantly be thrust back into that late 60s time, because it was a time when one could very well argue that we were actually far more divided than we are now. On all levels. And it was a true age divide. And at the same time, an era of great aspiration and great accomplishment. And that's what sadly thus far has not emerged from our time of great divide. But who knows? Maybe there's something magical in a 9 year. And we're going to be looking back 50 years from now
at the amazing aspiration that suddenly developed overnight.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I say we'll be looking back, I mean, you know, not without significant technological aid. But maybe
I need a 3D printer to reprint my organs.
Why am I laughing? What a wonderful closure to this show. But, you know, look, you might live forever, and who better to live forever than someone who's blowing himself up each and every week in live streaming improv comedy, right?
That's right. I'm going to be telling everybody. This is streaming. We're going to be regular streamers. Regular streamers?
All right. Well, I look forward to it. We'll discuss it again next week. That's the end of this show. You can find 100 of our 641 episodes now at chillpackhollywood.com. Many more each week continue to be added from the archives, chillpackhollywood.com. Of course, all our episodes we've ever done are at Blog Talk Radio. People can follow us on iTunes. Or they can subscribe to us via iTunes, and they can follow us on Twitter and Instagram, can't they, Dean?
They sure can. They can just go with that Dean and Phil, spell out the word and there magically we will appear on those platforms.
You know, we haven't put up many photos yet. I need to really dig down and do that.
find the photos of the two of us.
Yeah, I mean... The thing is it's just so sad because, you know, we've been doing this for so long, and it's like we were so young and beautiful when we started. But maybe we need a photo shoot, recreate the Harold Lloyd publicity shoot when we're when you're next here in LA.
Yes, blow my head off.
And thank you to Maurice Terenzio, in all seriousness, for such a thoughtful and detailed response. We knew we could count on you, Maurice. And everyone can write us as he did, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Till next week, I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund. We'll see you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.